Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. I am really glad the sun is shining. It's almost 50 degrees, so Fran doesn't need a jacket outside. It's beautiful. And we're going to really heat it up this morning with a phenomenal author with a great book called Revenge Unleashed. Hatred runs deep when your friends are killed, even if you are a terrorist. An attack on the central United States killed thousands of Americans, but also cost the lives of most of the fanatics. Not satisfied with the damage already done. Oh, these people were evil, let me tell you. The surviving extremists vow revenge. Their target? The man who played a key role in bringing their compatriots to the justice. They're going after the president. Standing in the way is a super-secret international counterterrorism group determined against overwhelming odds to prevent another disaster. And the author of this great book, An Enemy in the Heartland, is here, Stephen Schwartzley. Hi, good morning. How you doing?
I'm doing good, but you're warmer back east than we are out here in Phoenix. It's only about 37 right now.
Well, it's beautiful, and considering we had 90 million inches of snow the other day, it's great. And I have to say that the sanitation department up here did a phenomenal job. I mean, they are the best, because the next day the snow was gone. I mean, literally
gone.
I'll
tell you what, I used to live in Minneapolis, and I don't miss the snow at all down here in Phoenix.
I don't miss it either. But since moving from the Bronx up here, I was, like, ecstatic. And the next day I said, oh, gee, I can walk now. I can cross the street. There's no more snow. When I went down to the Bronx to get my hair done, I was impressed because it wasn't that bad. So we're getting there. So tell us, you wrote Enemy in the Heartland first, and then you continued this one exactly where the other one left off, which made it so much easier for me to follow. So you want to give everybody a little bit of a background on the first one?
Well, the first book started out as a writing that I did after I had a stroke in 2013. You know, it was kind of like a therapy. My wife's a psychologist, and she says, hey, do some writing, get your mind back out of that scrambled egg mess. And so I started writing about a drone attack that was focused on the center of the United States, because those people from the central United States, of which I am one, you know, think they're impervious to an attack. And unlike most people thinking that this was a religious attack, it was a bunch of college kids who went to university in England 13 years prior, and they were well-financed, a bunch of rich kids. And they came in the United States, bought up a pharmaceutical company to make some poison gas. They went and stole some military drones, and let the rest of the book be read by your listeners.
They better read it, because otherwise I'm not going to let them listen.
Well, the second book I wrote so they would stand independently, or at least pique their curiosity, go back and read the first book. But some of the terrorists were killed in the first book, and the survivors, you know, a couple years later realized that, the guy that was mainly involved in the capturing of the and killing of the terrorists was the head of the U.S. Senate Foreign Intelligence Committee. And, gee, guess what? He's the president of the United States right now in the second book. And so the terrorists can seek revenge. And so for him getting on, the case and solving a lot of it and going after their killed buddies, they're going to go back and get revenge on him. And that's where the title Revenge Unleashed came in.
Yeah, it does fit the book exactly. So we start out with the two at the end of the first book, who are Ginger and Ludwig. So how do they come into play in this particular one, and how come they only have a short stint?
Well, what happened was they were two of the masterminds of the attack in the first book, and they were thus, two of the survivors. And they go and finally make their way down to Argentina to hide out, like a lot of the old Germans in World War II days, they were guilty of war crimes. They fled to Argentina, so I figured that was a good fit. But then they learned from a cousin of theirs who's still living in Germany that was not involved in the first plot that the new president of the United States was involved in killing their friends, plus also their grandfather owned a munitions factory who financed the original attack. And the Olympic Committee that the president was part of at the time put a hit out on Grandpa on his corporate jet when he was flying across the Atlantic Ocean. So they're going, okay, we're going to make an example of you. And so they come back with a bunch of mercenaries, and they have a ton of money again, and they provide a factory for themselves to make drones, and they're going to go after the president.
Well, that explains why you created Jonah Maddox and Rye Munitions, correct? And for those
correct.
People out there that don't know, what are drones? I know because I looked it up. But what can you define the word drone and how we use them, how they would use them in order to, you know, do surveillance? Because that's what they're for.
Well, you know, a lot of times, you know, if you want to sit down and have some interesting reading, go on Google and go on to the Google Alerts. And I have a Google Alert for drones, one for terror, and one for terrorists.
Nice.
And every day you'll see drone attacks taking out some of the Al-Qaeda and ISIS people in the Middle East. I mean, it's like
a
daily routine. So, you know, so like anything else, you know, a car can be good for good or bad, and so can a drone. So, you know, the drones that these guys make were silently or secretly made a drone out of Nevada under a company that they formed, you know, a shell company, and they had all these kids putting these drones together, and mysteriously the kids don't make it after the drones are delivered.
Yeah.
They're kind of like quieted down. And these drones were, you know, loaded up with bombs and machine guns, and it's pretty hard to stop something that's about 4 feet by 5 feet long and zooming out of the sky, out of the sun, into your eyes to go after the president.
Well, they use it for that. We use it for other things, too, or for that also. I mean,
you're seeing a lot of drones being used right now by the police and fire departments, you know, go out and check out crime scenes or high-rise buildings where they've had fires, and they can fly the drones up a high where the hook and ladder companies can't get into, and they can even fly inside the buildings to take a look, see if there's any victims or if the fire's down. So, you know, a lot of drones are fun to fly and easily to buy, but the ones I made were, you know, a little bit bigger than what the guys buy at Walmart.
Well, how dangerous are they? What happens if the it's like a remote control thing? What would happen if it failed and it fell?
Well, I'll tell you what. During my research on Google, I found a kid doing some videos, YouTube videos, and he's Russian, and it's really funny. So, you know, once you guys are done listening to this interview, I'd advise if you want to go see something, you know, really frightening, and this video is probably 3 years old, 4 years old by now, you know, Google drones and machine guns, and you'll see this Russian kid come up with a machine gun on a drone, shooting down mannequins and blowing up cars. I mean, anybody can do it. I mean, this kid's, you know, not a, you know, a rocket scientist. He's a smart kid. But, you know, the only limitation on a drone is, you know, how long you can stay up in the air and how much you can carry.
That's scary. So, Jonah Maddox is not exactly a lifelong job, because if you know, once they're finished, those poor people, well, what could I say?
Well, you know, it's always easy to cover your tracks, and the bad guys had time to go out and recruit all these really outfits that were in these drone competitions, and once they hired them, they put them out in the middle of the desert up there in Mesquite, Nevada, northeast of Las Vegas, and they told the kids, hey, we got a chance to win this government contract for this, militarized drone, you know, so, you know, there's a specification for one set that had machine guns on it, the other set carrying these little bombs on it, and, you know, the kids do a great job of designing the drones, And lo and behold, you know, the head of the company, which is one of the terrorists, said, "Hey, we won the contract, so we got to make 24 of these drones.
Yeah.
And you know, once we're done, we're going to go party because this contract's put us on the map. You know, we're all going to be millionaires one day." And so the poor kids get on a plane, and the plane never made it to its destination. It kind of disappeared over the Bahamas.
It's scary. There was one character that stands out, though, whose talent was needed, was Randy McLean. How come they wanted him out of all of the people that applied for this contest?
Well, Randy McLean was a ex-CIA military person who, in his private life, was a pilot. And they needed somebody that was proficient in flying to fly these drones. In fact, in real life, you know, drone operators for companies, you know, are you know, highly sought after ex-pilots, even for the military. I mean, their drones that do the strikes in the Middle East, they're mainly flown out of Nellis Air Force Base in Las Vegas, half a world away, you know, and they're ex-fighter pilots. So it just made sense to kind of carry that same theme of who would fly these drones against the president. So he was one of the mercenaries, the kids, the heirs of the German munitions factory hired to go after the president. So he was just sitting on a knoll overlooking the site where the president was, and attacked him.
It's just scary because who's to say it can't happen? I'm reading Steve Berry's The 14th Colony, which is about the 25th Amendment and the 20th Amendment, and they're trying to kill the president-elect before he's elected, before his inauguration, so that there's nobody that's the president, and they want to get the vice president, too. I figured that out. I said, oh, that's what this is about. So this is scary. This could really happen, couldn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, the book, the way it starts out is, you know, there's this new president, and he's from Arizona, you know, because I'm from Arizona, and his name is Cartwright, and he's up in his name's in the middle, you know, I mean, excuse me, his age is in the middle 60, and I used a guy by the name of Raymond Baca as vice president, a kid that was from Florida, a Cuban family refugee member who was born here in the United States, and he becomes a senator for the state of Florida, you know, kind of like real life today, which you're seeing, you know, in the primaries. And then once the president is killed, he becomes the president of the United States. And so when I'm working on the third book, and, you know, he's the president in the third book, and the world even gets crazier than the first two books. And he's got to handle it.
Which explains why I'm glad you have the list of characters so that I don't have to go cuckoo trying to figure out who's who in America. Because that was my hardest
thing. Well, you know, there's a lot of characters
in the book.
Yeah, there's a lot of characters in the book because I wanted this to be, you know, as close to real life as possible, because there's, you know, multiple people that work together to find these bad guys. I mean, I can't remember how many they said on the news a couple of weeks ago after the San Bernardino attack, but, you know, for every terrorist that they know, it takes like 30 or 40 people to track that guy 24 hours a day. So, you know, in real life, if you know, I can't imagine how many, you know, threats are against the United States, but it takes more than just, you know, one intelligence committee to take care of it. And my premise for the first two books, you know, is simply this. You know, future wars aren't going to be fought against nations. They're going to be fought between nations and terrorist groups.
Yeah, that's what's scary.
Because they're harder to find. Yeah, the terrorists are harder to find you. You don't find them until after they committed their evil deed.
The scary part is they're all here, and you just don't know it. And if you don't know what you're looking for, they could be sitting right next to you in school, in your class, and you just don't know it, unless you know what to look for. That's what scares you, that you don't know who's your next door neighbor. And look at what happened with those two crazy ones in San Bernardino. They were right next door to them. Nobody knew. It's just hard to believe that they didn't know that they were there.
Well, what's coming out on that one, the latest things I've seen, is the neighbors knew, but they were scared to rat out the bad guys because they were scared of getting killed themselves, so, which is, you know,
that's
a valid
scary
fear. But, you know, but that's what these
what
people
happened
play on, is fear.
Well, they play on unfair. Too bad that they didn't have the guts to do it without letting anybody know that they were doing it. Might have saved all those people. That's sad. So there's two other characters. There's Helmet and Victor. And why are they so powerful?
Well, these guys are part of the old regime at the munitions factory back in Germany that controlled the bunny, and they were longtime friends of the owner of the company for years and years and years. And they help the kids organize the attack against the President of the United States. And, you know, Helmet was one of the guys that pretty much put together the shell company called Dronomatics out there, and then Victor was the one that was running the assault team against the against the president, because they picked a site in Louisiana, Missouri, where in the first book that was the first drone attack where a lot of people were being killed by drones, poison gas drones. So in the second book, they made a memorial at that place, and, you know, about 2 years later, you know, that's where the president goes, gives the inaugural speech for the memorial site, and, gee, the bad guys figure, well, hey, that's going to bring him out in the open. Let's go back and attack that site, but this time just focus on the president, not anybody else. And that's the basis of the book.
That's scary. So An Enemy in the Heartland... What happens when the Mossad agent is killed? How does Israel handle it when it's one of their own? And how many agencies are involved?
Well, what happens is the Mossad over there in the Middle East, you know, first it gets tipped off by a holy man, an imam. And because one of his friends was worried about his grandkids who was involved in the plot in the first book. And by hook or crook or circumstance, plus 6 degrees of separation, the Mossad agent is part of this international committee called the Olympia Committee, which is an entity formed after the example of the 1972 Olympics, where a bunch of Israelis were killed during the Olympics. And from that point forward, all these countries realized, hey, we need to share intelligence. So because of the massacre at the Olympics, they just called the committee the Olympia Committee. So all these different agencies, you know, the CIA, the FBI, you know, the German and Italian and all these different countries, all their intelligence agencies would get together every day, and by hook or crook, you know, they get an idea that something's happening, and then, you know, by circumstance, they get a couple good breaks and tracking down the bad guys in the first book, but they didn't get there fast enough. And once they did get there, they took out some of the terrorists, but, you know, by that time, you know, a couple of the key leaders, you know, escaped, and they escaped into the second book.
Well, there are spies on both sides. And that's the problem, because there's intel that somebody's giving about us to their side. And how do they figure out whether there's a mole on both sides?
Well, there wasn't really a mole in the storyline for either book. It was just that they took a couple accident reports or attacks, I should say, in New York City in the first book, where some key figures were killed in a high-rise building in New York, and some of the Olympia people from different countries, you know, had an alert, you know, something was coming down, and by security cameras, one guy said over in Israel, hey, this guy that did your, you know, building explosion in New York City looks just like the guy I'm looking for, and they start figuring, uh-oh, this guy's connected. So that's when it becomes a chase, going, what are these people up to, because they got some high-priced toys. And what they've done already is scary. You know, what are they planning to do? It could be even scarier. So
I know. It is scary. Because I imagine that on both sides, and I would hope on our side too, that people are watching 24/7. And that they're not, you know, taking time off. That there are people watching all the time. Because you never know when any one of these horrible people are going to attack anywhere in the world. They're not going to warn you. They're just going to do it.
Yeah, you know, the first line of defense for against a terrorist attack are civilians, unfortunately. But,
yeah.
you know, there's more civilians
yeah.
than there are law enforcement people. And, you know, I think, you know, the terrorists have got a huge advantage because they can pick and choose where they want to go. And our kids, you know, because of the school system and you know, perverts attacking kids, they're always told, hey, you know, don't associate with anybody out there that looks strange, you know. And sometimes these kids don't even look. They'll see something, and they just turn the blind eye so they don't get in trouble. And so these people, it's easy for the attackers to be invisible.
I know. It's really funny. Yesterday in my building, a lady came up to me from one of the bureaus, and I said to her, "What are you doing here?" She says, "Well, we're checking out the building for people that don't belong here." And I live in a very good neighborhood, and I go like, "You kidding me, kidding me?" She says, "No, sometimes we just pick them out when they come from other countries, and we want to know, you know, more about who they are." I got a very unsettling feeling about that, but I guess they didn't find anything, which is good, because they usually do an FBI check on anyone that lives in this building, and of course that could be fake too. I mean, like, we already know that. So when these type of attacks come on both sides, does anybody really win?
You know, it's kind of interesting. In my books, doing the research for them, I found out, for example, there are 17 federal intelligence agencies here in the United States. And you're going, what? Yeah, I only know about the FBI and the CIA.
Yeah.
You know, but there's, you know, there's the NSA, there's the NRO, which is National Reconnaissance, you know, organization. They're the ones that run the satellites, you know, getting the satellite data and stuff. So, you know, I think it's the big thing is how do you funnel all this information down into something usable? Because, you know, all these agencies have to kind of work together, and, you know, that gives the bad guys a pretty good lead time to get away with something, you know, first.
Yeah.
And he catches his can later. And that's, you know, but, you know, to me, you know, when you look at, you know, the real life terrorism that's happening today, you know, it's just, you know, it makes you cringe, because what I grew up as a kid, you know, my way of life is no longer available for the kids in the future or present day. You know, I just, you know, I can remember when my niece, after 9/11, she was a sophomore in high school, and one night her dad and I were having a drink by their poolside, and she comes up and goes, "What does this all mean? You know, we don't understand." You know, and she's 15 or 16 back at that time, and she's a smart kid. And we just said, "Hey, everything that you take or we take for granted now, you'll never see. Like, you know, no security lines going to airports, or, you know, some of your freedoms are going to be compromised." And I don't know if that's evolution or what, but I think it's pretty sad.
It is pretty sad. I mean, after 9/11, I was working in my school, and I had a little young boy from Pakistan that was in one of my reading classes, and I was the dean. And he came over to me, and he said, "Those kids outside are picking on me because of where I come from." And you have to know, I was 5 feet tall, little, and he's a big kid. I said, "Not to worry." I said, I got you back on this one. And when I came out, I explained it to everybody, and no one picked on him after that. I don't know how I did, but I did. I made my point. He was just a child that came from another foreign country, and he was being picked on because of where he came from. So there were 17 agents, federal agencies, and they're supposed to sort of share their information, or do they sort of work independently, and there's no one place that filters out everything so that everybody gets it at the same time?
Well, I found out that there's kind of like, I can't remember what the term is right now because I haven't had my third cup of coffee yet, but there are kind of like, inside each agency, there's clearinghouses, you know, where something gets, you know, put together. And, you know, in these little clearinghouses, there's members from all the different agencies, you know, scattered around the United States dissecting the information they get. So, you know, that's the challenge, is getting their, you know, the information. And then, you know, Do they have the resources to react on the information? And, you know, how long do you watch somebody, one of these bad guys,
yeah,
before you pick them up, before they do their deed? So, I mean, there are so many variables that, you know, the population and the government are at a severe disadvantage, you know, because these guys, you know, are like five steps ahead almost every time, you know.
Well,
so
they're not,
you know,
gonna
we're
wait.
Lucky to catch them.
They're going to do it. They don't,
you know,
care.
And the thing is, you know, the biggest thing I worry about as I get older is some of these people trying to take away guns. Because, gee, if
mm-hmm.
you see a guy with a bomb and you got a paperclip, the bomber's going to win. But, you know, if you got some weapons around your house, you might be able to take this guy out before he blows up 100 people. You know, I mean, to me, it doesn't make sense. And, you know, Chicago is a good example versus Houston, Texas. I just saw a piece on the Internet the other day. There's no gun
mm-hmm.
stores in Chicago, but their death rate per thousand is like, you know, 12 or 13. And then down in
mm-hmm.
Houston, it's like 1. You know, because people can protect themselves, you know. So, you know, there's an old saying, you know, a thief usually doesn't thieve again if he's been shot once.
Well, they have, I don't know if they have gun stores in New York City, because why would I need one? But I know they have gun shows. And I know that at some of the gun shows, they, you know, do a check, but a lot of them, you just go in and you just buy a gun. I think rifles, you don't need any kind of proof or anything. And that's what's really scary. And, of course, they're bringing them in from other places. And supposedly you can't do it at the airports, but there are ways that they get that they get through anyway for whatever reason.
If you go to the airport, you can give them a heads up that you're coming. And you can check your guns in. They have to be locked up and stuff. And, but, you know, it's almost like, you know, for no better terms, a special line, because there's a lot of hunters that come in from the
yeah.
East Coast out here to the mountains in the West, go deer and elk hunting. So, I mean, they don't buy the weapons once they're here. They do have them transport with them on their planes, or they have their own planes. But, you know, the thing is, you know.
That's scary.
You know, what's to stop them to come in and hiding out in your house, and if you got no protection, you know, nobody knows that they've hijacked your house. I mean, so
yeah.
Now that I've started the third book, the name of the third book is called Homegrown, The Unexpected Terror. And, you know, I wish I would have had it finished a couple months ago when the San Bernardino and Paris attacks happened.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, in the third book, Homegrowns, the terrorists are recruiting the kids here online in the United States.
Mm.
And it's going to be a huge attack, and we're not talking about recruiting one or two or three kids. We're talking about a couple hundred. And so, and I would imagine that ISIS and Al-Qaeda and whoever else is out there, they probably already have thousands of kids recruited here in the United States. So it's
sure
just a matter of time.
It's scary because these kids actually think that they're doing something wonderful, and when they're dead, they think they're going somewhere. They're going to be blown to pieces. They don't seem to get it. And then their parents supposedly get money or whatever, honor, and these kids are actually brainwashed into thinking that they're getting to do something that's wonderful when they're really doing something that's going to destroy themselves too. They don't care. So when creative attention...
I think you're... Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I think anybody that's hooked onto the Internet, which I think
mm-hmm.
is probably 95% of the people in the United States,
they're
yeah. already showing some blowback in England and Germany about this, you know, the local population starting to reject all these refugees and stuff because, you know, they
yeah.
know they're bad, and they're already starting to attack these refugees. And I think the worm has finally turned, you know, they recognize who these people really are.
Well, that's exactly what we had here with the Syrian refugees here, and so yet the president allowed them in. So you don't want to be where you're telling people they don't have a place to go, but then you don't want to have to worry that, who are you living next door to me? Are you going to blow me up, or are you part of ISIS or Al-Qaeda or whatever? And that's what's really scary, because you don't want to hate people, but kids are learning to hate, and they're learning the
well,
definition
see,
of the word.
I Yeah. See, I come from a different situation than most people. Mm-hmm. I met my wife online. She came in from South Africa a couple of years before I met her, 16 years ago. But, you know, 7 or 8 years after she was here, and she waited for her mom to pass. Her mom was old and had some problems. Once her mom passed, my wife applied for citizenship. She did it the legal way. And you talk about somebody gets really angry when she sees all these people just come in, you know, left and right without being vetted, as they say.
That's
and all
right.
this other stuff. She said, hey, you know, and I think, you know, the problem is, you know, we see all these vets from all the different services sitting on the street corners homeless, or they can't even get medical care through, you know, the VA and stuff. And here they're all complaining they don't have any money to help these people, but yeah, we're giving out money to complete strangers that are, you know, are here to not to do too many good things. I just get really angry, you know, and one day the people have to stand up to this.
Well, I understand that because I dealt with Medicaid for my mom, and it took me a very, very long time to get the services that she should have had in place a long time ago. Even now, with Medicare, the same kind of service when my mom had home health aides at the beginning for a couple of hours a day, they don't give you them as much. And yet, all of these people that are coming in are getting Medicaid, which is hospitalization and drugs and doctors and stuff. And there are different forms of Medicaid. I know that, too. Some give you more services than the other. So I could see where people would get upset because there are people that can't afford here that need the help. And then when they apply, they're told that they're over the limit or they can't get it. Or the red tape is amazing. If you don't do what I did and carry on like in a banshee, you're not going to get anything. So when you decided to create the tension and the meeting of the minds of all of these organizations, how did you decide who would be in charge and run the investigation?
See, that was the beautiful thing about having a covert operation, because nobody was put in charge. Everybody shared the information, and by kind of like committee, you know, they'd have their daily briefings or, you know, multiple briefings during the day. Wherever the bad guys were, wherever the wherever the closest assets were to go after these bad guys, they were assigned. So it was total cooperation between these countries, because, you know, they knew that if they didn't take out the bad guys where they can find them, you know, one day those bad guys would be at their doorsteps and they would need help of their allies to take out these bad guys. So, I mean, there was mutual cooperation. And, you know, even though the number of people that were aware that this entity, you know, existed were mainly just senior upper crust officials, you know, like, you know, the directors or deputy directors for these agencies, the FBI, CIA, or whatever that you wanted to call them over in Europe. It was just a very, very small handful of people that were kind of like the upper crust or the keener minds in these organizations.
I'm just wondering, as I'm writing, as you're speaking, because this is just me as an educator, I wonder what would happen if some of these people from law enforcement actually went into the schools to form groups of kids of different backgrounds to work together on different projects or different areas in history or different committees or different groups within the school to teach tolerance and understanding, rather than all these gangs and stuff and the fighting and, you know, the discipline and stuff like that in the school. Now, I was a dean. I didn't have a problem. I walked into a room. I'm little, and I just said, this is the way it's going to be. And they go, yes, you got it. And I had 3 cell phones, one for mother, one for father, and one just in case my phone ran out. And, you know, you had to use it once in a while, but not always. So I wonder what would happen if the schools got involved to teach them in high school and junior high school, you know, to cooperate and work together.
My wife being a psychologist, you know, she's always talks about young kids and, you know, their formative years and everything. And she always stresses kids really respect, you know, a person of power. You know, they don't like somebody wishy-washy, but if they can get their straight answers and believable answers, they respect those people. You know, the problem is, you know, all these, you know, law enforcement law enforcement agencies around the country, they're strapped for cash. I mean, you know, it'd be nice to have a policeman come in and do a class or, you know, present some information and just hang out with the kids so they're not scared that, you know, they're going to be shot like in Ferguson, Missouri or something.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is, you know, the police department, especially out here in Phoenix, and my nephew's a cop out here, they're so undermanned right now, they can't even go after, you know, all the bad guys. I mean, sometimes it takes 10, 15 minutes for my nephew to get backup out here because they're stretched way too thin. They haven't hired cops out here. You know, there was 4 or 5 years where the Phoenix Police Department didn't hire anybody, you know, as replacement cops. And then you had people, you know, policemen retiring because of, you know, medical conditions or, you know, then, you know, they put in their time or, they, you know, they just didn't want to do it anymore because they weren't getting the help they needed to survive. So, you know, it just, if everything was simple, we would be in utopia, but we're not.
So because of what you just said, and because of there are a lot of police departments, not just yours, that are short-staffed and short-funded, does that leave them open for more vulnerability for an attack? Is that why something like that would happen, like in San Bernardino or someplace like that, where they actually case it and realize that there's not a lot of backup out there?
Well, I'll put it this way. You know, terrorists are almost like stealth, you know, armies, you know, that they don't want to be seen until they're ready to do the attack. So just to run across one, you know, because of electronic chatter is one of the few ways that we have to catch those guys. And, you know, just the sheer manpower it takes to follow one or two of the bad guys before they do something is horrendous. And so, you know, our governments are being crushed just by the sheer demand for more manpower, and, you know, that takes money. So where does it come from? So it's you know, it's a catch-22. You're damned if you do and damned if you don't.
It's scary because it is going to be more. And there are children whose lives ended for no reason. And there's no end in sight. And that's what's really scary. And then you listen to all the debates, and you get more concerned as to which one of these people would actually know what to do if something happened, or to stop what was happening, or understand the ramifications of what to do and just take the initiative to do it. It's scary. It's really scary.
Well, that's why, you know, the first book, you know, where Enemy in the Heartland, where the terrorists, they come in. Once again, I have to remind everybody, they're not religious terrorists. These are guys that, you know, want to get revenge for what happened to their relatives during the first Desert Storm Wars and stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're just goofy enough to have the money and, you know, the mental abilities to put all these plans together. You know, they're college kids, you know, going to a really smart college in England. And so when they attack, you know, they want to strike fear, you know, and, you know, how many times has New York been attacked or the East Coast? I mean, you know, the Pentagon, the Boston Pipeline, so they wanted something visually, you know, scary. So that's why I had this drone attack around the northern St. Louis area in the first book. And then the way to really, you know, get revenge is make a public display. So in the second book called Revenge Unleashed, you know, the bad guys are going to target the president at the memorial where the first drone attack occurred. And, you know, there's several thousand people out there, and the bad guys don't care if there's any casualties, you know, civilian casualties. They just want to take out the president. And so when you have 24 drones with bombs and machine guns going after the president, there's going to be a lot of casualties. But, you know, I'll let it go from there because it's got a very crazy ending, the second book, that's going to leave a lot of people going, I want more.
I know, and that would be me. But before I forget, because I don't want to forget. I forget nothing. It's really scary. Tomorrow at 10, and I very rarely do two shows, but what can I say? Tanya Kappas, the author of Ghostly Demise and Ghostly Murder, will be here at 10. What happens when you own a funeral home, like Eternal Slumber? And in order for the bodies that you're about to bury to go to the other side, you've got to find out who killed them and deal with a whole bunch of wacky characters. It's hilarious, and it's really good. She'll be here tomorrow. Next Wednesday, How to Get Your Hot and Steamy On. I'm going to have a panel of romance writers that are going to tell how they write their romance scenes and keep it within somewhat taste. The week after, I'm going to have a panel of four authors, and we're going to talk about your best villain. Which villain in your book would you like to reincarnate and bring back, and why? And if the villain could speak to you, what would they tell you they would like to do next, and how come? I thought that would be fun. And on February 23rd, Dan Stone wrote Ice and Fire, and his two male characters are really hot people. You want to read it. And to end the month, Philip Margolin requested an interview with, guess who? That would be me, on violent crimes at 12 Eastern on February 29th, because he can't get up at 6 o'clock in the morning to do an interview at 9 or 10, so that's going to be fun. So that's just some of what this girl is going to be up to this month, and wait till next month, you have no idea. It's going to be even greater. So when this novel was created, how come you chose so many different locations, and what research did you do into airports and airport security?
Well, number one, since I'm from the Midwest, I went back a couple of years ago to see a cousin of mine that had cancer, and we were doing a bunch of things that we did when we were kids, and we went to a tractor pull, and it was on a Friday night around 6 o'clock in this small little town, and these tractor pulls are just kind of like a Midwest thing, but above the tractor pull, as we were pulling these weights down the track, was a drone. And I'm going, what would happen if that drone had a bunch of bad things on there and all of a sudden went after the audience? So that's kind of like where some of the ideas for the first book came into. But, these people don't even come through airport security. They got their own airplanes, so they don't go through the local, TSA.
Yeah.
So, a lot of money's wasted at airport security, because if they would get a bunch of dogs, they could sniff out, bomb materials a lot better than those multi-million dollar machines. In fact, I went to the airport security the other day where they had dogs out here when they had all these bowl games out here in Phoenix. And instead of waiting half hour, 45 minutes to get through security, it was like 2 minutes. I mean, people were just streaming through. Old tech better than new tech. But, I just made it so that, people that were reading the book had something easy to visually concept. Everybody knows what a drone looks like. Everybody knows, what poison gas will do from their histories, killing off people. So put those two things together and go out to the central United States where they think they're impervious to attacks. So that was scary enough. And then the second book, once again, there was no airport security or really anything that was going to really tip these government agencies off that, an attack was coming on the United States, especially after the president. So, it's kind of like the TV series 24, can the good guys go get the bad guys before they do it? So, but I just want to remind everybody that, hey, I've been fortunate enough to get all 5-star reviews on my books, and check out Amazon.com for the Enemy in the Heartland or Revenge to Unleash, because they're getting really great reviews even from military people that have read the book. They're putting on these reviews, and so or if they want a signed copy, go to my website stephenswortleyauthor.com and I'll autograph a book for the people. So, but on Amazon, if you're an Amazon Prime member, you can download the books for free, so go for it.
Oh, and they should. I went to the airport, and I went with JetBlue, and unfortunately, because of whatever, it's going to be a while before I can fly again, but they were great. And what I did was a pre-flight check. So I checked in online. So when I got there, it took me half a second to get through airport security. You don't stand on the line when you pre-flight check online. They ask you questions. You say, and you get through. The second time I did the same thing, and I was wearing a bracelet that went off as I went through. And I'm going, oh, my God, this is not good. I was very lucky because the guy said to me, I guess it was all that hardware you're wearing on your wrist. So I gave it to him and went through, and it was my bracelet. I was lucky because they were pulling people over all over the place. I have to tell you, the JetBlue was very, very vigilant. And, I mean, they must have pulled over maybe 40, 50 people just to be safe, which makes you feel good. But you can do it. So when you have a private jet and you don't have to go through all of this, isn't that dangerous for our security? Because they could just come in or leave the country and do whatever they want?
Well, see, what happened was they didn't bring any of the hardware with them. They just
got
here.
It here.
You know, and they were here for years. They were like frequent flyers. So, I mean, all that stuff, you know, alleviates, you know their scare of security. You know, they've been here for years. They were, you know, highly, you know, they were high members of these big pharmaceutical companies and construction companies.
Yeah.
They were the managers. So, you know, they bought their way into the system, and nobody ever knew. I mean, it was the perfect cover. And so, you know, when it comes to security, like we go back to earlier in the interview, the first line of security is the, regular Joe Blow out there on the streets. You know, if you see something, report it. But, you know, the chances are very, very slim for, you know, any of the government agencies to ever capture these guys.
No,
they're
not.
And
people have to know it's better to be safe than sorry. And I guess could do an anonymous tip and be safe than sorry. I'd rather be wrong than be right and wrong. I mean, I work with kids in the school system, and I reported child abuse left and right, and unfortunately, I was never wrong. So I would rather apologize and say, I didn't mean to say that or accuse you, than have a child go home and have to worry that they were going to wind up in the morgue the next day. And that does happen, which is really scary. So before we end, which characters are you bringing back in book three?
Book three, Homegrown, The Unexpected Terror. I'm bringing back basically the Olympic Committee, and you know, plus the plus the FBI and the CIA here locally in the United States who deal mainly with the Olympic Committee. But yeah, I'm throwing a twist into this book because most of the bad guys you hear about being trained by ISIS or Al-Qaeda, or, you know, being recruited, they're sent to the Middle East. Well, I'm throwing a twist into the third book. You know, these kids are being recruited, but guess where they go for training?
Right here.
No, they go to Mexico. That's where
Mexico?
This book's going to be. Yeah, Mexico this time, because that's where it's going to be total fiction, because once these kids are trained and they're attacking and this time it's not a drone attack, but this time when they come back, they could never get across our secure borders between the U.S. and Mexico.
It's scary, because Mexico I equate with drugs, with drug cartels and guns.
Yeah.
We're going to give them another. It's scary.
Put this in your mental cap. Go ahead.
So before we close, and oh God, it's hard to sit some so long. You're going to bring back some more terrorists, and you're going to be, who are the new people that are going to be brought in besides these kids that are going to want to kill us all? You're going to bring in any central characters that are new?
Well, the good guys, you know, most of the good guys are coming back. So it's going to be kind of another sequel. But the bad guys are really, this time, religious terrorists from the Middle East. Plus, they make an alliance with a drug cartel down in Mexico.
Oh, that's why.
So that's
cartel.
A weird combination.
Drugs,
and at the end, throw in for a real scare. Throw in a couple B-2 bombers, and you and I talked between the interviews. And guess what? Mm-hmm. You're one of the bomber pilots in the B-2. You want to be a good guy, so I made you a bomber target.
I'm really good at blasting people, so don't worry about it. I have good aim, too, so don't worry. This is going to be good.
Well, you'll have a half a billion airplane. Go do it.
Oh, goody. I can deal with that. So before we close, let me tell you that Stephen Schwarzley's book, Revenge Unleashed, is one of my books of a year for 2016. And I read something last week, and haven't done this in a while. It made me feel good to pick up a book and read it in like an hour and a half. Roller Babes by Tim Patton. For those of us that love the roller derby, this book was fantastic. Gives you the inside scoop, the violence, the jams, the history behind roller derby. And I happen to know that his research was impeccable because I know roller derby, and I used to go to it with my uncle. I was the only one in the family that loved it because I can't skate, but I love watching it. So this was one book that you want. Casey McKendrick is a gay author who wrote a phenomenal murder at Faux Pas Island. I was pleasantly surprised when I read it. It's one of those books that actually Frank couldn't put down. And coming out February 9th, and he asked to have it sent to me. I was totally honored. Alex Berenson, The Wolves. And I finished yesterday, and his publicist thought it was great. I love when people just say thank you. Jeffrey Archer, Cometh the Hour. You want to read that, too. It's coming out in 2 weeks also. And, of course, you want to read Enemy in the Heartland and Revenge Unleashed. And you want to read the last one by Stephen Schwarzley. And if you don't read all three, you're foolish. No, really, seriously. You need to read all three. And this is fun. And when is the next one coming out, and when am I getting it? Because I have a stack of 50 books inside, but you know I'm going to move us to the top of the list. You do know that.
Oh, yeah. Well, you've had some good comments in between our interviews, so I've enjoyed our conversations. But I'm trying to get the third one done right around November of this year. So it just, I could go faster if I knew how to type. But I'm about a 25-word-a-minute typer.
No, I'm pretty fast, but after this whatever, it's hard for me to sit for long periods of time. So where it used to take me like 5 minutes or 10 minutes to type something, it takes a little longer, but it does get done the right way. So those of you out there that haven't, read the books, I don't know what you're waiting for. And this has been great. This has been a lot of fun. And anytime you want to join one of my panel shows, let me know. Because we have a lot of authors that write on the same topics. It will be interesting to have a panel show, maybe in May or June, on exactly how you write, books about terrorist attacks, what you look for, the research done, and I've got a whole bunch of authors that write on that. So
let me know. And the only thing I would like to say to end the interview is, yes. The best way to thank an author is write a review. You don't have to write pages and pages, two or three lines is what makes me smile. It's not the money, it's the reviews. And, if you go see the reviews on Amazon right now, they've all been 5 stars. So I appreciate everybody's, compliments.
Well, I like when people write reviews because they actually read the book and write compliments about the book. I want people to understand, as a professional reviewer who does not get paid ever, that would be me, your job is not to say how many typos are in the book or the editing or grammar mistakes. Your job is to read the book and tell why you think the storyline is strong or not strong, and I don't write negative reviews ever. If a book does not warrant 3.5 to 4 stars, I won't review it. I will just write a synopsis for the author. I don't think that it's my job as a reviewer to pan a book. That is definitely not why I'm here. I'm here to spotlight the work of the people who give me the pleasure and honor of either quoting me on the back cover or quoting me on their website or just saying, Fran, thank you so much for caring enough to read my book. So for those of you out there whose books I'm reading 6 at a time. It's going to take me a while, but don't worry. I'll get you every one of those 50 books staring at me and the ones in here that are still staring at me. So, Stephen, thank you so much, and I will definitely let you know when I'm having the panel show, probably in May or June. And think about your evil character, any character in your book that, is your main central focus of the terrorist attack, and we may start there.
Well, I'll do that, and you better go learn to fly because you got to be 2 bomber coming your way in the third book for being my friend.
I can fly.
So. Thank you for having me on your show. I really appreciate your help.
Thank you so much, everybody. Have a great day. The sun is shining. Take a walk outside, and bye.